Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's July 8th, 2018, and welcome to episode 175 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find my
way? The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, trying to come up with topics and failing, and then just starting anyway. So I am your host today in Boston, Massachusetts, Paul Hagstrom, and joining me today from Toronto, Canada, is Carrington Vanston. How are you?
I'm excellent, and I still don't understand our theme song.
Yes, that's true.
Because what is up with the theme song for this show? He asked during episode 175.
Yes. I think actually, there's just to tease this a little bit, I think Jack has some ideas.
Excellent.
So it's possible that we might not be hearing much more of this theme song. But
we will hear Jack's new rendition of it.
that would be perfect. More about
hello,
the Wizard of Oz.
Is there anybody there?
Okay, all right. Also, joining us for the first time in a long time, so we're happy to have him back, Michael Mulhern in Sydney, Australia. How are you doing?
Oh, cold. But I like the song. It mentions Oz.
That's true.
Yeah. I'm always wondering why everyone wants to come back to my place.
I don't mind the song, really, but I think I'm in the minority. most of the time I hear from people there saying, oh, I just fast forward through that.
Well, of course you should.
Oh, you mean that small group of people called listeners?
Yeah.
Both of them fast forward. I'm one of them. Yep. As soon as that ad read starts, I'm like, click, 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 click. Where's the show?
Oh.
Right.
I thought you had that ad on repeat.
I actually do it live every time. I'm just really good at saying it the exact same way.
Yep.
I'm in awe.
All right. So I am the host today, and I'm responsible for the host's topic, and we don't have a host topic today.
And you're responsible.
it always happens. It's suddenly the recording date sneaks up on me, and actually, we have a lot of stuff to do, though. So, well, a lot of stuff to get through in our nominally sectioned podcast, even though all the sections are the same. But just depends on who put the link in the show notes, basically. But so we'll start with listener feedback and the links and thoughts that we got from there, and move on to the other sections as we get to them.
I like it.
I like thinking about this as a sectioned podcast, also. Mm. Since that has a different meaning outside the U.S.
Oh, right.
Okay, let's see. So Andy wrote over email to sort of just ask what it was that having 512K made possible that we couldn't already do. And he was sort of noting that we already, even before we had computers that had this massive amount of memory in them, could do VisiCalc and GEOS and, you know, other things. So what was the sort of the quantum leap that it allowed.
Wait, you guys have 512K? Oh, man, nobody tells me anything.
I didn't have any particular, I don't have any wise things to say about that, but either of you?
Yeah, I did. I was working for a computer store back including 1984, when a Macintoshy thing came out. And I got to play with one of the first ones here in Australia, and I thought it was cute. I loved the interface, and I found that trying to do anything on it was a little bit constrained, so I went back to using 8-bit Apples. They seem to manage their 64 or 128K of RAM so much better. They're not having to muck around with that GUI interface. But when the Fat Mac came out with its 512, it just seemed to suddenly work a lot better. You were able to operate on nice big spreadsheets and have that lovely graphical user interface all at the same time. Before it was, sluggish, but pretty. Mm. So I found it a very good move for the 512. And I suppose that's one of the reasons why I haven't even bothered trying to get one of the original Macs into my collection. I'm quite happy with a 512K Mac. And then, 512K, that kind of thing, I always found that made DOS a lot more usable. Heavens knows why you'd need so much RAM for DOS, but to me it was that magic amount that just made playing games on PCs so much better, spreadsheeting and whatnot on Macs and other graphical interfaces just that little bit more bearable.
Well, so with the Mac, I guess my feeling about that is, I mean, it sort of matches your impression, but it's basically the Mac needs 512K to run, and yep. They released it with a quarter of what it needed to run. So like the magic of 512K is actually uncrippling the machine.
Yes, exactly.
But even so, I mean, that it had a GUI, and that was one of the things that it needed all this memory for, but the Apple IIgs had something like that too, right? Although I guess you also would put that much memory in the GS as well.
Mm-hmm. Like a megabyte and a quarter or whatever.
So maybe that's the quantum leap.
And having run GIOS on a 2C, that was a fun... I think I did it once, but that was just a floppy drive machine, and it was pretty, but pretty awful.
I hear that.
Yeah. I have to say, have I said this? I'm sure I've said this, but I hated the Mac when it came out. I thought, this is dumb. You can't do anything on it. It's super slow. It's, for people who don't understand anything about computers.
Mm. I had the exact opposite experience. I saw it and thought, that's the future. Everything else is dead to me. Gimme. Like, right away. Like, it was crazy how I just completely fell in love with it. Like, instantly.
Huh.
And it was so underpowered and such a, so many disappointments. But, like, on first blush, I was just completely sold. I just drank the Kool-Aid completely.
Huh. All right. Anyway. Okay, so... I don't know if that answered Andy's question. He also mentioned one thing that I wanted to say here, which was that he wasn't able to download the last episode, RCR 174, which is the mostly Atari-centric episode that we did. And hopefully not a lot of people... I know some people were able to download it. I was. Although there was a problem right at the beginning. I don't know what... I'm not sure what the issue was, right? Like the first few minutes it was out. But I was getting errors then. So if you're hearing this and you didn't hear the previous one, go try it again, because it may work now.
Darn that Atari stuff.
Yeah,
was
that's what it was. It's attempting to censor.
Yeah, turned it off and on a few times. Should work now.
Right. Okay, so let's see what else we have. So Michael wrote on Twitter to point out a Ars Technica article called "The Macintosh 2SI Today," and it was basically just we'll have a link there in the show notes, and it's basically just asking the question of how far does 20 megahertz of Macintosh 2SI power go today? And it's somebody who's basically just trying to, as we've talked about a couple times in the recent past, attempted to kind of just see how far you can get using a 2SI in kind of a modern environment. I don't know. I sort of skimmed over it. Did any of you read this more carefully?
I read it and with a critical eye, because I am of the opinion that you couldn't get much done with a 2SI when it came out. It was a remarkably crippled machine. We had them at work. So this is the era when there were like LCs for the low end stuff at work and 2CXs and 2CIs, and the SI was just a terribly crippled machine. Like, if you're going to pick something from that era, it's one of the worst ones, particularly because the video RAM steals from the actual RAM. That's one of the ways they made it cheaper. So you have less RAM than you think, and it's just like, oh, it's a terrible machine, a completely broken one. I'm a fan of Macs from that era, but not this one. So they were able to use it and set up with a beautiful portrait display. That's the tall ones that look like at the time I really was kind of hoping monitors of that ratio would take off, the ones that were taller than wide, more like a piece of paper than a movie. Sometimes I kind of wish things did go that way, but whatever. But other than that, oh my goodness, that's a crippled machine. But they come to the same conclusions that everybody does. You can type things, and it's harder than other things, and you know, not a lot of groundbreaking stuff here.
Right.
Hard to read, though.
So the 2CI replaced the 2SI?
No, the 2CI replaced the 2CX. In fact, I don't even know if it was a replacement. Yeah. I think maybe they came out at the same time. I think, if I remember, Mo, as a long time ago, that the CI was the one that had the full floating point coprocessor, and the CX didn't, maybe. But they're both 030 machines, or 68030. And the SI was also one, but was like super crippled and had crappy RAM, and it was kind of like a cheaper version. The CX and the CI both came in the larger, was slightly larger, chunky case that's the same as the Quadro 700, but sitting flat instead of on its side. So many models of Macs, my goodness.
Well, let's see. Wait. No. The CX and CI are just squares, I think, aren't they?
Yeah, they're the same as a Quadro 700. It's that squarish box.
700.
Yeah.
See, what a terrible
era. This was a problem with Apple at the time.
Yeah, I used a 2CX. Almost the only 2CX I ever saw was one that I used in the physics department at college to program little like particle interaction simulations. Mm. But
we had a bunch of them in a graphics department, like maybe a dozen of them or so, CXs and CIs, so using Quark and stuff on them. So we used them as desktop publishing machines. And they were good for that. I remember at the time they were good for that.
I think random thought time, but the 2CI, I think, was one of the most, like, the highest sellers that Apple had at that time. I mean, like, there are a gazillion 2CIs out there.
And it was a really good machine. Like, the CX was slower, and if I remember, the CX was like a 16 megahertz machine, and the CI was 25, so that's a pretty big percentage-wise. But it still sold for, like, $6,000 or something. It's crazy how much more expensive, and that's like at the time. So it'd be probably like a $10,000, $12,000, $13,000 machine today. Like, it's bonkers how expensive computers were in the late 80s, Macintoshes in particular. So but it had the 32-bit clean ROMs, and you can get a level 2 cache. Like, it was a good, decently powerful machine, and had that top they could open up and get at the slots. Like, so it's nice, easy access to things, throw in Nubus things, and good expandable, you know, hardworking computer.
Excellent.
Yeah, the CI came, or rather the 2SI came later. Like, my memory is the CI came out in like 89 and the SI came out in like 91. So it's like 2 years later, and it's a worse and crippled machine.
Ouch. Okay.
Well, welcome to late 80s, early 90s Apple.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad I missed out on all of that Mac time.
Yeah, you probably are.
I was still using my Apple IIc right up to 93. So
there's a link that I don't think we have, but maybe we can find at some point, that was going around recently. Somebody did a fairly recent interview with, I think, Andy Hertzfeld. Do you know what I'm talking about? Has that hit your Twitter feed?
It has not.
Okay. No. I'll find this at some point. But maybe this seems like a good place to drop that link in as well.
It is relevant to my interests.
Yes. Okay. But I will move on away from Apple this time. Quite a few people mentioned on Twitter particularly, but I think on email too, that so we had, I think maybe two episodes ago, was it two episodes ago? I think so. This Omni Entertainment System, this 8-track based like game that you could, like home game that you could buy in the 1980s.
Or some of us could buy now. Apparently,
right,
Paul.
Yes. So I did, in fact, buy one. But many people wrote to say that there's a place called Techmoan that did a really quite elaborate video on this. Carrington, did you see this video before?
I had not seen the video before. I found it because people responded to us because we had talked about the Omni. So a couple of people posted things on Twitter saying, hey, here's this amazing video. And it is an amazing video.
It is very, very amazing. Yeah.
Absolutely the kind of thing we should have linked to at the time, but I did not know it existed. I'm glad I know it existed now, because it in no way made me less enamored and in love with this Omni thing. It has caught my attention. My mind is on fire with how awesome I think this thing is.
Yeah, it is pretty wild. So I did, in fact, buy one. I think it wasn't the one that we actually linked to, but it was a different one, and it's huge. And it has, so each game basically comes on an 8-track set, and so there are 4 different programs. So I didn't actually understand how 8-tracks worked, but it may be that 8-tracks achieve stereo through having 8-tracks, 4 programs. Does that sound right?
Sure. Why not?
But at any rate, so each cartridge, cassette, tape thing has 4 different things you can do, like 4 different games or 4 different, trivia sets or whatever. And on one channel is the audio. And then there's some other thing on the other channel, some sort of instructions of some kind, some data on the other channel. And so that would be kind of fun to attempt to reverse engineer this.
Mm-hmm. It makes some sense then that they're probably in stereo pairs or whatever, and they're just using like the left for the audio and the right for data.
Right.
So can I ask you, if you've got one of these, have you played around with it at all? And can it just play regular 8-track, like, music things? If you pop one in, can you play old Dolly Parton 8-tracks?
Well, I can say I have not tried that, but the reason is I don't have any such 8-tracks.
Could, you've now got the world's coolest stereo.
Yeah.
Like, for your office, that would be amazing.
This is a pretty weird thing. But anyway, yeah, so I have a couple of these cartridges, not a lot, but I have a couple, and I'm kind of curious to know, how the data works. But this video that we're linking to actually goes into this in quite a bit of depth. The machine is disassembled, and you sort of, you get to see what's inside and how it all works. And actually, there's a link to, so I don't have any of the Vincent Price cartridges, but there's a link to some of the audio that includes Vincent Price, with movie trivia or whatever it is.
Oh, so that would just be so awesome.
Yeah.
And listeners, if you have any Dolly Parton 8-tracks, send them to Paul.
Nah, it's okay.
Send them all to Paul.
But, all right, so thanks everybody for telling us about this. This was the whole system was news to us, but apparently other people recognized it I can imagine anyone who saw this for the first time would remember it after that. So, okay. So moving on, Quinn wrote over Twitter to point out that regarding our recap of who won the 80s home computer wars, she says the answer actually is Acorn, because while Mac and PC sort of like beat up each other for all these decades, ARM took over the world. So that's probably true.
Well done, the Brits.
Yeah.
Hurrah for the good guys. Well, actually, they're not.
The what?
There are no good guys. Have you not learned that lesson yet?
Are we the baddies?
We got the skulls. We're wearing black.
Okay, so Mark on Twitter pointed out an interesting entry on Ken Sheriff's blog. Now, we've linked to various things on this blog before, and this particular thing is from 2013. It is what he's done is he has reverse engineered the Sinclair Scientific calculator and provided a working simulator of it that actually has the code, his reverse engineered code, on the right, and you can sort of, as you work the calculator, it will run through the code and actually sort of do things. It's a really interesting write-up. So I read through it a bit, and essentially the idea is that Sinclair wanted to release a scientific calculator, but did not want it to be super, super expensive. And so they basically took the kind of functionality of the HP 35 calculator and sort of did a bunch of algorithm tricks to try to, get it onto like fewer chips and something sort of cheaper. And so as a result, it has a couple of weird bugs and things like that. As usual on Ken Sheriff's blog, this is, the detective work is astounding. It's super fun to read. Am I the only one who read it?
Alas.
I the only one here?
No, I'm here, but I didn't read it.
Okay.
No, I'm looking at it now, and wow.
Yeah, it's something.
Yeah, going to bookmark that one.
Yeah. I mean, it just the sort of audacity of it, like, well, we can't sell a calculator for as much as it would cost to do all these things that we want this calculator to do. So we're going to just figure out how to do it with weird integer math tricks and stuff. Anyway, very interesting. So thanks, Mark, for sending us that. Todd sent an email mentioning an extreme refurbishing of this is
unreal. I don't even understand this. It is crazy.
Yeah, and this actually seems to be a genre of some kind.
It makes no sense to me at all.
But essentially, this is somebody who has gotten an Atari 800 XL in unbelievably terrible shape.
Like a car drove over it.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it looks almost as bad as something that's been sent through eBay.
Yeah. Oh.
But I mean, just
everything's bent,
missing keys, cracked, like literally like somebody took it and bent it so that it shattered, missing pieces, it's like it was hit by the sledgehammer, and it's filthy, and it's missing bits, and it's rusted, and it looks like it's full of mold, and they're like, yeah, let's make this one be like new. I'm like, you can get another one. I mean, I applaud it, but it is crazy to look through the photographs and see this. The effort and stages that went into refurbishing this. It is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It definitely looks like Thor's computer. Oh, damn computer. Whack.
Yeah. He goes through, sort of remolding bits of the case. And, you know, there's a really sort of interesting thing where he makes a mold, like a silicon mold or something of the back.
That will never cure.
Yeah. It takes a couple of steps. Oh, yeah, and actually it wound up turning out, I think he borrowed someone else's computer to make this mold, and then it turns out that the writing on the ports actually survived in the mold as well, although he wound up having to get rid of that because of sanding it down or something like that, but anyway, whatever. It's quite interesting, and, you know, it's in a sense it's a little bit like, you know, climbing the mountain because it's there. I mean, like, you really could just buy a new one.
Or rebuilding an old car or something. Yeah. But it was really funny because he documents the failures. Like I was talking about, like, he attempts to do a silicone mold of one part using some old silicone that literally will never cure. He's going like, I keep trying to get it colder. Days go by. Like, why is this still just liquid? So it's funny to read through the process, and it's amazing to look at the end. Now, another way to do this, you could buy 5 or 6 of these in successively better condition and just take some photos.
Yeah.
But it's amazing. Way more effort than I would do.
I like how he's taking the hammer to straighten out some of the bent up metalwork.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, in the end, it doesn't look new exactly, but it looks amazing.
It looks amazing. It totally looks amazing. I completely applaud this. It is remarkable, and I could never do it.
Yeah. All right, let's see. So also we got so this is another thing that kind of went around on Twitter. Steve sent it over email too, that Sid Bolton, who is the founder of the Personal Computer Museum in Brantford, Ontario, passed away, and to me at least this was a surprise. He was 46, and so I do not know anything more about that, but we're linking to an article in the Brantford Expositor, which is like a local newspaper, where the headline reads "Computer Wizard Founded Museum," and it's actually sort of talking about the computer museum, which apparently was something that even the town was proud of. And I had never—I was sort of aware of it. I'd never, gone to it or anything, but. And I don't know now, of course, the question is going to be, what does the museum continue, and that sort of thing. But it's sad to hear anyway. So
What's sad is we talked about that museum literally years ago. The only reason I know about it is it came up on the show here once. And I remember even at the time saying, oh, I should go do that. I should go to there because it's not that far away. Like, that would be less than an hour and a half's drive from me. It's just west of Brantford is a little town west of Hamilton. So an hour and a half, something like that to get there. And I never did. That is so relevant to my interests. And yet never did I drag my butt over there. It's amazing the things I don't do that I then regret not doing.
Yeah. And I mean, it's conceivable that the museum will continue, but Sid Bolton was the person who made it happen, and it was his thing, and so I don't know I don't know for how much longer it would keep going, or if it would keep going in the same way. So,
and 46 is very young.
I have to agree.
Right. I have revised my opinion of that since I was a very young child, and I'm now firmly of the opinion that 46 is remarkably young.
Yes.
Yes, it was about 10 years ago.
Yeah, right. I remember it fondly as a young,
I remember
youthful time.
It whizzing by me as well, and I definitely did not feel old at that time. But now I look at it and go, what? What? So that is a real shame, and it's a sad thing.
Yeah. Okay, and I think I will leave it there. So basically, what I'm looking at the show notes, and in the show notes we have a little list of like feedback that we've gotten from people. And right now I've reached the point where in probably the past 5 episodes I've stopped and said, well, we'll leave it there. And so what that means is that everything that's below this point is like really, really old, and I think maybe.
We gotta move
on. We're just gonna declare, you know, Carrington's bankruptcy.
I like it. Yes, data bankruptcy is a good thing. Jason Scott has different opinions about that, but
yeah. All right, so we will now move on to the next section, which is items of interest and news, which is links we came up with ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, Carrington, you have the first one.
Excellent. Well, I am going to talk about and give linkies to the Computer Literacy Project, was a BBC project from the 1980s, basically ran from 1980 to 1989. It was a really cool thing in that the BBC and the government over there decided that computers were going to be a thing, and the general public needed to lift them up by their bootstraps. And how does one go about teaching people about computers if they're going to suddenly be flooded into the world? How do we raise general computer literacy? How do we get the public to understand what are they? What are they for? What should you worry about? How to use them in business? How to use them for fun? What do you do? Well, they decide to create some programs, and under the umbrella of the Computer Literacy Project, they put out a whole bunch of programs, many, many, many episodes in a few dozen different programs. There's Managing the Micro and Computers in Control, and like just all these things from the 80s. And all of them have now been made available online to watch for free. And it's an amazing archive. So you can head over to computer-literacy-project.pilots.somethingcrazy-long. Anyway, we'll have a link.
That is a really, really long domain.
It's a remarkably, remarkably long URL. Before it just keeps going. I'm like, at what point do I see a .co.uk on this? It just goes and goes. But the archive itself is incredible. It's got tons and tons, I mean, literally hundreds of different episodes of vintage computer things. They're all interesting. I've been dipping in and out of things and watching stuff about graphics and sound and using computers, using a micro in your small business, and just it things about what is a floppy disk and how do you connect one, and just it's amazing. It's an incredible archive. So I'm gonna have a link to it. I'm hoping because the BBC does have a habit of sometimes going, Doctor Who, screw that, let's erase everything. I'm hoping somebody grabs all of this stuff and also throws it into archive.org, which will have an easier URL. Right now we'll link to the crazy long official BBC website about this. Everything's available, everything's online right now, and everything's free, and it's amazing.
Yeah, that's really cool. I haven't had a chance to look into this, but I'm looking down the drop down menu and it says what? Watch any of the 267 programs.
Yeah, and lots of them are 50 minutes, over an hour. Like, it's a crazy amount of stuff.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, I was almost thinking that it might almost be kind of neat to have a curated segment or something. Say, like, all right, well, you know, we watched Managing the Micro episode 5, and you know, go watch this. This is cool. Like, if anyone has recommendations among the 267 programs there are, it might be kind of useful to sort of pinpoint a couple. If anyone comes across something that's specifically, it could be that they're all wonderful, in which case just watch them all. But
one of the best ones I found is, the programs was called The Learning Machine. And that's one I would recommend. There were, I think, only 6 episodes in it, but they're really cool. There's one from the mid-80s about the gender gap and how this is a problem in computers. Great program from 1985. There's one about why educational software is so crappy. So, like, and it's like a half an hour about what is wrong with educational software. And like, so it's a little more irreverent, I guess. It's neat. Anyway, I like that one. And there's one that kind of picks apart BASIC and says that, like, BASIC is a terrible language, and we like, so I dig it. Like, so that's one I would recommend in particular. So the Learning Machine. So all those episodes are online.
Cool. All right. Yeah. I'll start with that. All right, Michael, you have the next thing.
Oh, the next one is one of my favorite topics. It's Lego. So what we have here is the start of Evan's Lego Robotics Virtual Museum, and the URL is mindsbeforethestorm.com. Now, I'm assuming that that's to get round a little bit of Lego intellectual property rights, so
Not using Lego as in the URL?
Yes, and yeah. Also that it's Minds Before the Storm, so it's all the robotic Lego that was out in the wilds before the wildly successful Lego Mindstorms robotics. Evan has started his virtual museum and gives us a little bit of a blurb and is starting to go through, as I said, all the Dacto and all the other bits and pieces that Lego had out there before Mindstorms. So if you want to find out a little bit more about Lego, or as some people would say, lots of Legos. Ooh, that grates. Every time I say it, it grates.
I think Lego. I might just beep that out.
So I just came to. Somebody must have said the plural of Lego wrong, and I passed out again.
Oh, yes. Evan has his own bit to say about the L word down the bottom as well. And
oh, really?
Evan, you're wrong. It's Lego. I know, Evan. We discussed it over some messenger about his habit of mispluralizing Lego.
Right. Yeah, it's like soup or soap, right? Yeah. Lego.
Your Lego. Yeah. One Lego, two Lego.
Well,
two very sore feet.
I'm going to eat a lot of spaghettis.
Yeah, you don't. I mean, like, if it's like soup, then you don't really usually have two soups, right? You have two like things.
Depends
of
how
soup.
Hungry I am.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have mushroom and
bricks of Lego,
couple of spoons.
Yeah.
We have found a topic for the show.
Yeah, shark fin soup. I could go two soups.
So Evan has, I think at VCF East and maybe a couple other places has done actually Kansas Fest. I think
yes,
he did
Kansas Fest last year. He bought his laser and was demonstrating the interface card plugged into the expansion port of the laser. I believe he's also putting together an earlier card with the serial one. He's trying to get a the APL2 Linux Apple emulator running on an old DOS laptop and using the interface card for that. So he's definitely getting involved with Lego in the wonderful retro world and building up things. So also for the museum, they're currently setting up some interactive displays with Lego so that kids can basically get in and play with Lego as we were able to back in the days. So it'd be interesting to see how this goes.
Yeah. Yeah, the Lego robotics stuff is really pretty cool. I never used it after, you know, the only time I ever sort of interacted with it was this early technique time. But I have some amount of this stuff, and I'm hoping to play around with it. But it, you know, really did exist on a bunch of different platforms, and you can get the card for the Apple II and the card for the PC.
Sounds like a great foundation to start up a new Robot Wars, though.
Yes, right.
So we go and build our own telepresent robots out of Lego.
Right. Well, didn't what's his name? Alex Lucas.
Alex Lucas. He's got a Lucas. Wonderful blog on his website. So I think we should include that as well, because that is just got so much information in it as well.
Right. Yeah. So he's got information about how you can build. Like, if you can't afford, it turns out anything that says Lego on it is super, super expensive, because it just is.
Oh yes.
So on Alex's site, he's got a circuit diagram, you know, of the card, at least the Apple II card. So if you want to build your own, because it's a nothing card. There's nothing on it. It's it's basically just communicating directly. It's
those four letters that make it expensive.
Yeah, exactly. And it's because they're capital.
Yeah, it's Danish for give me your wallet.
Right.
Capital expenditure.
But so the way this actually works is that the card interfaces with a little black box called the interface A box, and that has in it I think it's four different on off things, and so basically what the card does is basically there's a byte, 8 bits, and the bits represent whether the thing's on or off, you know. So there's like four sensors and four outputs, and it's really all it's doing is just communicating that bit or that byte, you know, across to the box. So the card is nothing. It's quite easy to build, yet it's like $200 if you want to buy one. But yeah, Alex, I think what sort of led me to say this was that at Kansas Fest maybe 3-4 years ago or something, Alex went and was working on a sort of like a, I think a Wi-Fi, or maybe it was a Bluetooth serial card.
Bluetooth, yeah.
Yeah, which leads me to, you know, back around to the robot war with the Lego robotics. You know, like conceivably you could wirelessly connect these things, perhaps even over the internet, so that people in different parts of the world could have robot fights with physical robots. New project. Retro
Challenge
2019. Okay. Very coherent little topic. But check out Evan's page.
As coherent as any other one that we do.
True. Okay. Let's see. So I have just a little thing to point out. So we were informed about this on our Facebook page by Lim, so this is actually a Android augmented reality program that he wrote, which basically puts a vintage computer of some sort in your physical environment. So if you're looking through your phone, you can put an Apple One or a PET or Apple IIe or something on your carpet. And I don't know if any of you have played around with these. I don't have an Android phone, so I haven't tried this. But there's a similar one that someone else made called Homebrew Club that's an iOS app. And I have played around with that a little bit, so you can put like a Sinclair QL or something on a table and then sort of walk around and look at it. It's pretty weird. It's kind of cool, though.
Weird is good.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing is it's not expensive. Second thing is it doesn't take up actual space. So if you want to just feel like you have a collection, I think it'd be pretty cool if this were developed to the point where you could actually interact with a computer. Like there's an emulator in there, you could type on it, but it's possible that's going a little too far. Right now you can just sort of see, you can see what your couch would look like with a pet on it.
Yeah, well, they could bring out the PH edition and then they call it Avalanche.
They could.
I think I have missed something.
Oh, but your office. Oh, I would love to have. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Like, as you scan around your office and your gaze settles on a machine, that it pops out in VR so that you can play with it. But if you glance around the room too quickly and pause on too many machines, it all falls on you.
Nice. And then your phone self-destructs. All right. Anyway, so I thought that was kind of cool. Take a look at that if you're, it's kind of a neat, quick thing to try out. And I don't know if it costs anything, but if it costs something, I'm sure it doesn't cost a lot. So, and I'm sure there was some work went into it, so that's also probably fair.
Right.
Okay, Carrington, we can move on to the next thing.
Well, the next thing is interesting in that it came and then it went, and I don't know why. So on Fast Company, the magazine, on their website, they posted a very interesting article called How Apple's Advanced Technology Group Changed the World. And it was all about Apple's Advanced Technology Group and how it was founded in the mid-80s by some people at Apple who had previously worked at the Xerox Palo Alto place, and how they were mandated to just like come up with cool tech versus, you know, work on a particular project. So it's not about like, hey, we need a new mouse for this particular computer, or we're looking for a monitor. It was more like, do neat things, and then if you invent neat things, we can put them into our projects, and how really amazing stuff came out of that. For some reason, the article's gone. It's been yanked down from Fast Company. So there's a bunch of mentions of it online still, because other people were linking to it, and I have no idea what caused it to get yanked down. I don't think it was Apple complaining about it, but it is no longer there. I still think it's interesting because I had read the article, and so I think we'll still have a link to it because maybe it was taken down accidentally or just being edited or something, but it has vanished from Fast Company. They no longer admit that it's there. You just get 404 errors out of everything that talked about it. Can't even search for it anymore. So we'll also link to, say, the Mac Observer.
I can see it on my screen. I clicked on the link and I can see
really?
It.
Really? Oh, because like for me earlier today, it yanked down and it just gives me 404s.
Yeah,
you guys are looking at a cache.
I don't know.
No, it's the first time I've been there.
Well, maybe I'm looking at a wrong cache. But yeah, my link, when I go to it, yep, 404. If I do a search for it, won't give it to me. Fastcompany.com is, for me, denying that it exists.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Maybe your prime minister is not as nice as everyone thinks he is.
He is not. So, that is actually true.
The legendary Apple research group that shaped our world.
Yes. Well, I'm not allowed to see that anymore. Article 901-76202 is denied for me.
Weird.
But they did cool things. They invented like the stacks, and they talk about HyperCard, and they talked about a whole bunch of neat things in this article that is now denied to me. Denied to me.
Yeah.
QuickTime VR. Yeah.
That'd make a great article. Someone should write it.
Yeah.
Fateful LSD trip, building software and system that can play video. Yeah.
Yeah, they worked on something that is still a sore spot. They worked on OpenDoc, which I was quite keen on in the era of CyberDog and all that. And I thought this could really go somewhere and this could be cool. I have a CyberDog pen still. OpenDoc was a neat little thing, but it went nowhere and it got killed. And too bad. So, but I miss it. Well, I don't know if I miss it, but I had hopes for it. It was never really that much of a thing, but I played around with it and I liked it. So anyway, if you're able to read the article, then you should do so. Well, it still exists.
Well, what I've done while we were discussing this is I've gone to the Wayback Machine where that article is not, but I have saved it into the Wayback Machine.
Excellent. Nice try, Fast Company. Too slow for Paul.
So, yeah. I think...
So basically, all our listeners who aren't in Canada can click on the link, and then all our Canadian listeners can also click on the link at the Internet Archive. And I will just go quickly go and code a Carrington filter so he can't even see it at the Internet Archive.
Everybody has one of those eventually.
Oh, see, now that's weird. Okay, so what I have is I've saved it on the Internet Archive. I've gone to that page, and what I see is 404. The page you're looking for is not cannot be found.
Me too. Ooh. Fast Company is doing funky things.
That's... Well, okay, so...
Inconceivable.
You've heard of ad blockers? Well, they're just going to start bringing out like article blockers.
Yeah.
Let's see. Command P.
Now it could be an ad blocker thing. It could be that if you're not a member, you're allowed to like look at an article once on Fast Company now, and they block you going forward or something. I don't know. But anyway, it was there for me, and then it was gone. So there you go. It's here. It's gone. Well, just like the Advanced Technology Group itself.
Oops! I just saved it as a PDF.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's probably the thing to do, actually.
I don't know how that happened. You know, so suddenly, Command-P, enter. Oh, the computers, they got a mind of their own.
So if you can't see it, it's a neat article.
Yeah. And Michael will send you a PDF.
Michael will send you a PDF, because the article is ephemeral.
Yeah. All right. Everybody needs these animated little computer movies, according to Michael.
Oh, look at you avoiding the word. Nicely done, Paul.
Paul, what are you trying to say?
What file format are we talking about, Paul?
How do you
pronounce it?
Yeah.
We had this discussion before, and Blake is one of the more ardent supporters of one of the views, and said that apparently the way I pronounced it caused him to drive off the road.
Well, did you say GIF?
I did not.
No, Paul mispronounced it.
Anyway, go ahead and talk about the these animated things.
Okay, these animated GIFs.
Oh,
I'll be back in a GIFy.
Yes. with some gifts.
Okay, so over at Motherboard, there is a wonderful collection of little computer graphics. And using the magic of GIFs, we see text coming up on the screen, keys moving on the keyboard. Yes, it's riveting graphics. So you're
weighing riveting graphics.
You know, you're weighing cool. 2200 or your ADM 3A terminal and even some real things further down. So Apple II, yeah, blah, 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 HPs. It's a bit of a recurring theme. I love the Holborn 6100 from 1981.
Me too. That's out of 2001, yeah. A Space Odyssey.
It is. It's cute. I would love this to be the sort of, to get in there and so like move my mouse pointer over it and click the keys myself. But I think that's going a bit beyond the capabilities of these animations. But, they are great. I just love it, love it, I love it. Hell, it even makes an IBM 5150 look good.
Yeah, these are really nice.
Mm.
And that Holborn, yeah, I mean, like it's come up before. It has,
but
I don't understand.
Like this.
Oh yes, yeah, no, like I've never seen the animated form here, but what I don't understand. Everybody loves this thing. I mean, like you look at it and you think, oh, I would love to have this.
It's ugly like E.T., but cute
like E.T.
It's gorgeous, and I want one so badly.
What I don't understand, so it says in the text here, at least, it says they made 200 of them, you know, like none of them, basically. And what I don't understand is why no one made one like it. Like, why hasn't somebody now made them? Why can't we buy a 3D printed Holborn?
Especially because they're quite a white computer, like, so they 3D print easier than some other things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they kind of have a 3D printed whiteness to them.
So, all right, new project. whatever, they're beautiful.
Or just the shell and say, like, put a computer in it, monitor. Like, I would use this monitor.
Yeah.
Anyway, these little animated things are gorgeous.
Yeah, I wonder how it would upscale to a, say, a 23-inch LCD
it would
monitor.
Fall forward.
Yeah. Well, it'll actually be lighter than what the CRT in there is.
But the wind resistance. Yours blows over.
Well, there you are. There is our transportation issue solved as well. So you go outside, hop onto your skateboard, and you use your 30-inch LCD Holborn as a sail.
Perfect.
And compute at the same time.
I see nothing wrong with this plan.
It feels like I should be able to segue from that somehow to the thing I have to talk about, and yet I'm not quite sure how.
Well, let's go there anyway.
So the thing I had is not exactly related, but it feels kind of related. It's a page of Commodore 64 Papercraft.
Is that the World of Papercraft?
No, Rocky Bergen design. So this is basically instructions on how to print little like pieces of paper that you can fold into the shape of a Commodore 64 and a monitor and a drive and a VIC modem and a printer. And they're just really quite cool looking. And, the designs are free. You can just print them, and they look quite nice. So.
So if you're in the mood to crumple up a Commodore 64, for instance, as sometimes some of us might be, this is a nice, cheap way to do that.
Yes. No, they look really nice, though.
They really do. Papercraft is pretty impressive.
Yeah. So, and actually, that's the whole extent of that bullet point on the show notes for me. But
I think I've got to at least do just the C64 part of that, so to add it to the Christmas tree decorations with the apples.
Yeah. I actually don't know how large this is.
Oh, yeah, you could print one that's even larger than full size. Ooh, put it on cardstock.
So when you want to drive over the Commodore 64.
Right.
Run down the street hitting people with a Commodore 64.
Again.
All right.
Moving right along.
Yeah. Carrington, you have the recurring news item.
Just a quick note about this. Yeah, we had talked about the applesauce. Paul loves that name. We talked about the applesauce a couple episodes ago, and it is now in production. So, or rather, it's in assembly. And so if you are looking to get one and you have signed up, there should be an email saying, hey, you know, Time to go. It's money collecting time. So the first 100 of those is getting put together and should be shipping out shortly.
Yeah, I've given my monies. I've converted several wheelbarrows of Australian monies into US into just a small billfold. And hopefully mine will arrive just in time for WOZFest 10 on July, so that I can do some WOZing at WOZFest.
Cool.
And there's also a note on the site, so we're going to link to like the official applesauce FTC.com site is up now, and the initial run is a run of 100, and you never know what these sorts of things or any vintage hardware project like. Maybe it's a one-and-done thing, you know, get them while they're available. And there's 100 units, they're all spoken for, but there was enough people tried to buy it, there's enough overflow, that a minimum of a second run of 100 will be created. So how quickly that will come and go, who knows? Will that be the last ones ever? Who knows? So if you are interested, it makes more sense to kind of get in line for batch number two now rather than wait, because you may be disappointed.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, I hadn't actually looked at this site. I got invoice number 3.
My goodness.
I wasn't number 1, but I was quite close. So we'll see. But unfortunately, it's coming so close to Kansas Fest that I decided I'm just going to pick it up there. So we'll report back from Kansas Fest to all of our imaging adventures. Because I assume there's going to be a lot of them there.
There will no doubt be imaging adventures. Yeah.
So... Yeah, I guess if you're coming to Kansas Fest, hopefully everyone will bring their discs to be imaged if they aren't getting an applesauce. But
mine was invoice 23. Bugger.
Uh-huh.
That's the problem with being on this side of the planet. Every time someone goes and opens up and starts things over on your side of the bloody planet, I've got to wait until I wake up.
Right. Just don't sleep. That's the trick.
Yeah, but, I think that was the other cause of some of my problems.
Yeah, I think I basically just happened to see right when he announced that he was taking pre-orders. I saw that announcement, and so I got in like immediately, and then.
And only 2 other people were faster.
Yeah. Who are those 2? Anyway. Okay. Anyway, so that'll be cool. I was kind of hoping that I would we'd have them by now, but of course, you know, like it's just all down to like shipping the parts to John, but they took longer than he'd hoped. So I'm very excited to get one. All right. WOZFest was mentioned, by the way. So Saturday, July 21st in Sydney, with a video hookup to Kansas Fest.
Mm-hmm.
So if you happen to be one of the few people out there who are listening to this and are in Sydney, then you probably already know Michael.
They are pre-warned.
But
yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Yeah, I don't think there are any shows that we have not mentioned before, but Kansas Fest
have
is coming
up. Have we mentioned Kansas Fest?
I think it may have come up.
Does it exist if I don't go?
That's not how existence works.
I think it's like, you know, trees clapping in forests or something.
Michael,
right?
Does not have object permanence, apparently.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Oh, yeah. And now a word from our sponsor.
I hope I can talk my parents into buying me an Atari 800XL.
Huh, tell them all the things it can do for you.
Right, I'll tell them it's got 256 colors and 4 sound channels.
I don't know, that's a little technical. Why don't you tell them it'll help you learn music and art?
Well, and there's integrated software for word processing, spreadsheets, forecasting.
No, tell them it'll help you write term papers.
I'll tell them it's expandable with serial link peripherals like modems and disk drives.
Tell them it's your birthday.
The TG Leisure Center arrives at Arding and Hobbs and smashes the price barrier. With the five-function Sinclair Cambridge percentage calculator, now only $7.95, including, yes, including that. The 13-function Cambridge Scientific with logarithmic keys for only $12.95, including that. See all the superb Sinclair range at the TG Leisure Center at Arding and Hobbs, Clapham Junction, Southwest 11.
And we're back. All right, so this time the host's retro computing gift idea was actually suggested on Twitter by Randy, I think. And it is a TRS-80 Model 1 Raspberry Pi case from Retro Pi Cases. I think it's in the UK, and it is just a cute little Raspberry Pi-sized little gray and black and white Model 1 recreation. It's very, very cute. So,
Model 1 inspired.
Mm. Yeah. And I think you're right. I think we did link to one of something else, one of the cases of a different computer from this store before, but this one is adorable.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that there's a bunch available, and it's the Commodore ones cost more for some reason.
Right.
They keep breaking?
Could be.
It's just weird. If you get a BBC Micro or whatever, it's or this one, or the Atari ST, then they're less expensive than the Commodore 64 or the VIC-20.
I think probably if I were going to get two, I would get the BBC Micro and this one, the Model 1, TRS-80 Model 1.
But the problem with getting the BBC Micro one is it's in PAL. So.
Right. Mm. Actually, also, I think it's big. In order to make it be the right dimensions, the Raspberry Pi is actually only part of it. It's like two Raspberry Pis wide.
Mm. Mm.
Whereas this one is really cute. Like, if I got one, it would totally be this Model 1 version.
Yeah.
This one's gorgeous.
Yeah. This one just says, buy me.
Yeah.
A lot of things say that to Paul, though.
True, true. But this one, at least it only costs like $34, right? So anyway, so get that. I don't know. Actually, I didn't look to see what flavor of Raspberry Pi it requires. But
Raspberry flavor.
There are so many now. It's getting a little hard to keep track of. There's the 2 plus BA 3.
Ever since John Sculley took over the Raspberry Pi, it's been a nightmare.
Right.
It will fit the Model 1 B plus, not the B, then Pi 2 and Pi 3. Yeah. Yep. Yep. So, yeah, as long as you've got a Model 1 B plus, or a 2 or a 3, it'll work for you.
Excellent. And the placement of the ports and stuff like that, it all looks nice.
Works.
It fits.
Yeah.
It totally works. It's one of the nicest cases I've seen.
Yeah. So. All right. I'll have to get some of these. But while we're waiting on that, we can turn to eBay. And Carrington, you have the first one.
I've picked a book and a reason to not buy it. My favorite things.
Perfect.
So the book is interesting because we've talked many times about collecting stuff, of course. And this is going down that rabbit hole because it's a book about collecting. It's a vintage book called A Collector's Guide to Personal Computers and Pocket Calculators, which I think is awesome. And it is available on eBay, and it's a neat looking book, and it's got a buy it now of $50 because vintage books can be quite expensive and cost $20 shipping to get to me. And so that's expensive. But I really like this book, so I am recommending the book. It seems really cool. But as is often the case, if you find a book you like on eBay, go look elsewhere. Places like abebooks.com, a terrific site to search used bookshops. And so I searched for this book on abebooks.com, and somebody's got it for $22 and only $11.50 shipping for me. Now, lots of other people have this book on abebooks for crazy money. That happens too. But before you ever buy a book on eBay, often it's better to go search other places. And that is the case here. So we will also link to the book on abebooks, and you can get it for half the cost. And I say, go get that. And it's a neat looking book. So if you're interested in collecting vintage computers and you want to find out what they were worth, I guess, back then, which is the one you should have collected back in the 80s,
right,
then this would be the book to get.
So when is this book from?
It is from
1993.
It's 93. Okay, so 93. So if you want to see what in 93 you should have been collecting from 83,
right,
this is the one for you.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a neat looking book. It's a book I would very much like to browse through.
Mm.
Just not a book I'd want to drop $70 to do that browsing.
Yeah, $30.50 Australian for me.
But it's neat because it's subtitle is a historical rarity and value guide. So I really want to see the inside of this book, but I can only find pictures of the covers. But I really, really, really want to read the inside of this book and see what it has to say about the computers from the point of view of 1993.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be quite interesting. I just scanned a book. It was like a consumer guide to computers that was from, I think, 1985 or something. And so it had a lot of those same computers in it. And it was actually, it's really sort of interesting. So that's sort of contemporaneous trying to decide, like, do you want a Radio Shack programmable calculator, or do you want a Epson QX10, or do you want a Commodore or whatever? But it was actually sort of interesting. This particular thing was interesting because it had all of the big things in it somehow. Like, most of these books that I've seen in the past have been pretty light on certain things, but this book basically has just like all of the collectible stuff. Like I have all of those things.
Right.
But anyway, I find it
interesting because this book in particular, because it's a collector's guide. So it's like somebody in 1993 mm-hmm. who is collecting computers from the 80s. Because the pictures in this are late 70s, early 80s thing. Well, I guess mostly late 70s. This shows a Apple II disk drive and a Sol terminal. Uh-huh. But it's interesting that it's like somebody, like I think of vintage computer collecting as something somebody would have been doing for the last 10 years or 15, but the idea that in 1993, there was already a market for collecting the computers of the 80s and late 70s. So,
yeah.
Oh, I want to read this book really badly.
Yeah. And it's totally true that, I mean, like, if only I had started then.
You wouldn't fit in your office.
Well, that's true. I'd probably be homeless and unemployed at this point. But nevertheless,
you would have bought a whole bunch of Apple Ones and
yeah.
made a house out of them. So anyway, it's 366 pages, so it's a significant book in, you know, one definition of significant.
Right.
Mind you, having a look at Abbey Books, there are some prices there that actually make this eBay auction look cheap. £226 for something that's got still got a 4-star rating like the one that you've linked to. So.
Yeah, so technically you could buy this book on that site, and then flip it for $10 profit on eBay.
It doesn't work that way, does it? Yeah. Not when I try.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on to the Michael, you have a couple auctions here.
Yeah, moving right along. Yes, the first one is a Lego interface card and sealed software. This is just to illustrate the silly prices that these interface cards can actually take. So for a mere $299 US, buy it now, you can have your Lego interface card. But at least it does come with the software that's sealed, unopened. So you have to take it on faith that what feels like a floppy disk in there is actually a floppy disk. And the Manuels, so, yeah. Or you could get the schematics and make it yourself.
Yeah, I mean, you can see in the auction, this card, it's got a 6522 on it and, like, nothing else.
Nothing else, yeah. I think it actually would make a good first project for someone who wanted to make an interface card.
Mm-hmm.
It's not overly complicated. You could get a little bit arty with what you want to put on the PCB because there's so much room. Give it a go. Save yourself. Change out of $299 for buying the parts, etching your own board, putting it together. The software can be downloaded. Go for it, kids.
Well, I mean, the other thing about this auction, I mean, like as we were saying, yeah, anything that says Lego on it is expensive, and I think this is kind of cool. But the thing is, you can't do anything with this. I mean, like once you have it, what do you have? You have a card that doesn't plug into anything. You know, like you need the interface box, you need the motors, and you know, so getting the interface box itself is another thing you need to do.
I'd pay $300 for that interface box. But you could make that yourself too.
There's actually one.
Well, technically you can make your own Lego, but there is a point at which effort.
Well, last year we made Lego.
Oh, that's true.
No, it was the year before. The year before we made Lego.
Right. I think Kat did it.
Yeah, and it was yummy.
It was awesome. Actually, that was a really good session. I forgot about that. That was super fun.
Make your own Lego and eat it.
Yeah. It turns out that... let me actually just stick this link in here. Well, okay, so two things I want to say. First, there is a appropriate interface box. It seems to be missing... Is it missing something? Maybe it isn't. It's a Lego Technique Interface A box that would plug into that $300 card. It is a $20 buy it now, so somebody doesn't know what these things are worth, which means it's probably going to be well long gone by the time this ever actually gets out. I will
because
not buy
you're
it.
You're going to buy it.
How long do you think it's going to last?
Probably not very long. Although, I mean, the thing is, you have to know to search for it. Like, if you have to know this is a Lego Technique Interface A, because it doesn't say anything else in there. Yeah, and I won't buy it because I actually have a bunch of these. But what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, there's a super annoying thing about eBay these days, which is that probably 2 weeks ago or something, they changed the way you link to old finished auctions. So if you link to an auction that's done, instead of showing you that auction that's done, it says it takes you to an active auction that it thinks is kind of similar. So if it seems like you're clicking on links in the show notes and they're going to just like weird, crazy stuff that's not like what we were talking about, it's because eBay has now changed the way they do this. And I'm still trying to figure out how to, I think there's a way to short circuit it to keep it going back to the original.
I think I clicked on some of those older links and it basically just took me, you could scroll down and click on original link, original item or something.
Right.
But it's annoying.
Right.
Very annoying.
There's a way to do it, and so I think probably in the show notes I'm going to try to start encoding them with that, you know, whatever the parameter is in the URL.
Yeah, I remember seeing it on Twitter somewhere, and I just can't find it.
Yeah.
So we should go back and change all of our existing links. Awesome.
Nope.
But I guess I could script it.
Yeah, moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I accidentally clicked confirm and pay. Oh, okay.
Okay, sorry. So you're getting this interface box?
Clicked. Yep, this link has ended. Oh my goodness, this listing has ended.
Okay.
You guys. Oh, you guys.
It's on its way to Nevada.
Cool.
Which is where the other me is.
Yes. Area 51, right? Is that where that is? Where is Area 51? I don't know.
I don't know. They don't want you to know.
Yeah.
If you think you know where it is, maybe you don't. Okay. Now, the other item, which, trust me, I am not clicking on, buy it now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very cool.
It's very nice.
Oh, it's very nice. Unless, of course, you've got a lazy $2,200 US just kicking around and you woke up this morning and said, what will I spend this two and a bit grand on? Well, I've got the link for you. What we have here is an IBM FNB 1410 system scale model on a beautiful wooden plaque with an IBM logo. It's just... it's cute. Now, if I could put my Raspberry Pi in there somewhere, I suppose you could do one of those Pi Ws. Yeah, you could sort of like slip that in somewhere.
But presumably this is like an architectural model or something.
Mm.
It's really cool. It's like a teeny tiny little model.
It's so well done.
Yeah, although it kind of looks like it's supposed to be on someone's desk, though. Like, maybe it used to be an architectural model that they've mounted.
Or you're right, or maybe it's an architectural model that was presented as, like, to somebody that worked on the computer or to their team or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's really cool. Like, as a display item, if you had this on a shelf, it's pretty awesome. So definitely, as long as the links still work, people should go and look at it.
Yeah. Oh, I think this link will be working for a while. But it's so much nicer than a hunk of Perspex with some engraving on it saying congratulations on the project, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, this is nice.
It's the blah, blah, blah that hurts.
Yeah. Oh, I saw a good one. Jason Scott tweeted a picture of, it was Yahoo buying GeoCities, and all the team that worked on that seemed to get these plaques and had some big silly amount of money for what it cost. And it was a lovely looking piece of Perspex, but we know where GeoCities went and we know where Yahoo has gone.
Right.
Yeah, flush.
Yeah, this is... I would really like to someday get one of these, like, mainframe models. There do exist, like, much more elaborate ones than this that I think actually were used to try to plan out rooms and stuff. Or just sell them. You know, like, I think, you know, salespeople would bring them around and set them up. But,
And for this amount, again, you can have the real thing.
Well, right. Yeah,
2,000 for the model, or we can hit you for, or what, 25 grand for the real thing?
Which is also a model, it's just a one-to-one scale model.
Right.
Yeah, and Paul will go, no, could I have 12 of the models, please? Well, that's it for me. So, two totally impractical items at silly prices, and thank you, Paul, for the interface box.
Sure, no problem. They do come up. I mean, that's one thing. It is
not at $20. They don't. Sorry, well, guys. Sorry, listeners.
Yeah. I mean, I did this too for something. I forget what. Oh yeah, that little luggable toy.
Oh right. Yes.
But yeah, you do have to know what to search for. But if you aren't looking for these, sometimes the people, it doesn't say Apple II on it or anywhere. And actually, this interface box works with any of the cards. Mm. But, you know, if you know the terms, sometimes people aren't going to know what to charge for them. So, anyway.
Yeah. Well, Paul, what yes. else have you got to tempt me with?
All right. So I have a bunch of sort of miscellaneous things. The first one is a rare Coleco Atom disk drive. And I thought this was interesting mainly just because I didn't know there was a disk drive for the Coleco Atom. I thought it was a tape-based system. But apparently there was a disk drive. And you can, if you want to just buy this one, it's $275. But if you want to just look at it, it's free. So, and the person who's selling it actually has a CD full of disk images, I guess, that you could put on floppies with this drive if you wanted, but has the owner's manual, and it is shown working on the on a demo Atom in some of the pictures, so running CPM, it looks like. So, pretty cool. I do not have an Atom. I do not know if I ever will have an Atom, but here's a...
I'm sure you've got many Atoms.
Yes. Billions. All right, let's see. So, the next thing, this was not super interesting, but there's a VIC-20 being sold, and it just caught my attention because the keyboard looked weird. I don't know if there was an official VIC-20 that had this weird keyboard, or whether this is a replacement keyboard. This keyboard does have a Commodore key on it, but the keyboard is gray and has gray function keys, and I think that's not the right color for a VIC-20, correct?
I prefer to think this was a special Shatner edition of the VIC-20 you could get.
Could be. You never know. I mean,
someone Shatnered all over it.
There are European ones. I think the European one, it's a German one or something called the VC-20 because VIC turns out to be like some sort of vulgarity.
That's awesome.
And this particular one comes with a knockoff data set called a Data Master. anyway, whatever. It's not a super interesting auction, except that it had an interesting keyboard. Interesting keyboard.
It's not a bad little starter kit.
Yeah. But a VIC-20. I mean...
No.
You might as well get a Timex Sinclair.
I would rather have a Timex Sinclair.
Okay, so the next thing I have is actually... I've never used this, but I have one of these. It is a vintage Datatran Corp DT4 data tracker. But what it is, basically, is a bunch of little blinky lights that you put in line in an RS-232 so you can sort of see what signals are going across the cable. And it looks neat, you know. And I think it actually has little pins that you can attach wires to, and there's little dip switches that I think will be able to like send or impede the signals. So it's basically a piece of test equipment, but it blinks and has little red
and green
lights.
It's like a first beta test of the Matrix.
Yeah.
I don't even see data connections anymore.
So, anyway, it's a $30 buy it now, and you know it might just be kind of an interesting little toy. Actually, it would be pretty cool to put in like in line with your modem
just
or something.
Just in line
like
with anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a blinking lights.
Yeah. I was gonna say if you like retro green and red LEDs, this is for you.
Yeah.
And I think I'd have fun making the adapters just to plug it in between things.
Yeah. Yeah, and it should just fit basically anywhere that you would normally have connections like this, you know. So, come to think of it, you could like the Wi-Fi modem, right? You could put the Wi-Fi modem on one end and this and
yeah.
You know, whatever, log into level 29. But
I love me blinking lights.
Yeah.
Show me more.
All right, so the next thing. This is a Perkins Elmer Fox 1100 terminal in working condition. I never heard of this thing. But it sort of looks a little bit like the thing we were talking about before. What was it? The whole Holbrook
yeah,
hole?
Yeah, without
but cheaper.
And without the ET aspect.
Yeah, it's
sort of
stumpy.
But it's still gorgeous.
Yeah,
it is. Absolutely gorgeous, and it's a fifth the price.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
I've never heard of this before. I mean, it's just a terminal,
yeah.
So and it says some of the keys are sticky, but that might not be that hard to repair. But physically, though, it looks great, and it's a very, very pretty terminal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's similarly white or off-white, I guess, and it has a little badge with a sort of pleasing white, blue, black pattern.
The only downside is it's local pickup only.
Yeah.
So hopefully you're in California.
Or South Carolina.
Or hopefully you're in California and want to drive, is what I meant.
Oh.
Let me finish.
All right.
I want you to work for it.
No, I won't be driving to get this one.
Yeah.
I don't have the schnorkel on, the car's not big enough.
Yeah, it does. I mean, the description does say, like, this is not going to be shipped. So you have to go. Like, it's not local pickup only as an accidental setting on the listing. The seller says, no, you have to come get it.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was cool to see, even if it's not something that you can come to get. I think it would be pretty neat to have that on your desk to interact with your terminal window on your Mac or whatever. But or your Raspberry Pi. That's perfect. That would be great, actually, to have this terminal to, like, a Raspberry Pi that's, you know, inside your Model 1 case.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's see.
Your next choice is something I want desperately.
Oh, really? Okay, so
yeah.
I should cover it. But
you should totally cover it.
It is a Teletype ASR35, a automatic send receive Model 35 ASR. And it's a Teletype. It's a desk shaped printer with a keyboard.
It's a desk size metal thing.
Yeah.
And there is no better way to use Twitter than this thing. Like, it would be the ultimate tweeting experience.
Yeah. It's so mechanical.
It's gorgeous. It's like it's in relatively nice shape, and just like this huge metal desk size Teletype. Oh,
yeah.
I don't even want a lot of stuff, but I want one of these things.
Yeah, well, if you get one of these, you won't have any room for any other stuff either. So
you don't need other stuff.
Yeah.
You only need this, and you sleep to the sound of the clack, clack, clack.
Yeah. It's one thing that's kind of cool about this particular auction, if anyone was seriously thinking about the $3,000 buy it now that it is, and this one is in St. Paul, Minnesota. So,
but you can drive there from California.
That's right. If you want, it is possible. I don't think you can drive there from Juneau, but anyway, is that correct? I don't think there are roads to Juneau.
Sure there are. There's the Alaska Highway.
Okay. Wasn't there? I thought there was some place that was sort of like only accessible by like seaplane and
boat. Australia.
Anyway,
I don't think we're on the Alaska Highway.
The thing I was going to say was that this comes with some manuals and stuff too. I mean, like it's not just a piece of junk that somebody found in their attic. You know, it's actually, you know, it was sort of kept together with some stuff as well.
Mm-hmm. And it's nice to see them zoom in and see the typing of this is a test of a Teletype. Like, even the ribbon has ink on it for the paper part. It's just so cool.
Yeah.
So expensive and so big and so cool.
Right. So, yeah, if anyone's looking for a present for Carrington,
impose one of these on me.
Yeah, right. That's probably slightly better than giving you like a horse or something.
Yes. Can't tweet with a horse.
Very impositional present.
My girlfriend disagrees.
Yeah.
She very much would prefer another horse. She's wrong, but we'll work that out.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. So, and much cheaper. The next thing I had listed is, and I think this has definitely come up before now that I think about it, but it's inside the personal computer, a illustrated pop-up guide. This is a book. It's a pop-up book of computers. We've seen this before, right? I have one of these, so I must have talked about this.
I think we talked about this. It's amazing. Like,
it is.
It's everything you would want a vintage computer pop-up book to be.
Right.
It even has a little printer. Like, you can pull the little slot to the side.
And the floppy drive.
Like,
and the floppy drives are so cute.
Yeah.
Everyone's got to have one of these.
I disagree, but I do really like it.
It's not super hard to get. It's, I mean, like, I think I got mine on Amazon. This one's $35 on eBay.
Yeah, I picked mine up off Amazon for silly dollars. Yeah, it was so cheap. It was unbelievable. It cost me more to have it shipped.
Right.
And I mean just to my transshipping address at Nevada.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a pretty cool little thing. If you're, you know, not sure you want to collect stuff, this is another way to do it. If you want to get one step beyond augmented reality to actually have something you can hold.
It's analog augmented reality.
Yeah. I wonder why I've had... So the next thing I had on this list is this ridiculous little pin. I'm not actually sure what I was thinking when I put this in this list, but it is a Great Plains Software logo pin badge.
Because Great Plains Software was awesome, you were a big fan of crappy accounting software?
Well, I bought one of the pins, actually.
okay.
It is sort of interesting. It's the logo of a accounting software company that I think it still exists today under
I think
like
they got
Microsoft.
Under Microsoft, yeah. I think Microsoft bought them ages ago. In fact, I call them crappy, but I had very little experience with it. I just used to be frustrated because I used to have to interface other things to Great Plains Software, and it wasn't fun.
Oh, really? Oh, okay, so you actually had experience from before.
Yeah,
because I've got most of the Apple III versions of these. You know, they date back. This is super old. I mean, like, they date back all the way to the Apple II, Apple III days. So, and this was the logo that they had. In fact, I think this logo went away after a while. So, if you wanted a pin to commemorate the accounting software of the 80s and early 90s, here it is. $7 buy it now. You know, not a big deal. Actually, ships from Portugal. And so I did buy one. I'm not sure why, and then I put it in this list. I'm still not sure why. There you go. And then the last thing is I think this is kind of cool. It's a deck mug. It's a digital corp mug. And it's this sort of, what does it say? It's like stone pottery or something. Stoneware, speckled stoneware pottery mug. And I sort of like that material. But the fact that it says digital on it is also kind of cool. So that's about it. That's about it for all, what I have to say about the mug and what I have to say about auctions. But all right. Anyone want to comment on the mug?
I would like a digital mug.
Okay.
I don't really like the speckled look, though, but I would have a normal digital mug.
Okay. Well, we'll set up a
this
watch list.
This is not the digital mug for me. Yes, I will have to set up a watch list. I was drinking out of my Kansas Fest mug earlier during the show. I made tea.
Ah, you have a Kansas Fest.
I do indeed have a Kansas Fest mug.
I didn't know they existed. Where did you get that?
They did them.
Is that one of the ones that came with the bottomless coffee?
Nope. It has the bottom. Much more useful as a mug that way.
Yeah.
I got the Blondie Hacks edition.
Ah, yeah,
oh, no, yes.
Yep, yeah, yep. Yeah. Yes, I got one of those.
I love
and
it, love it, love
I,
it.
I continuously tested its function as a mug that year.
Right.
I kept going back for my cups of coffee.
All right. I think we made it. I think we've made it to the closing discussions.
Well done, us.
Yes. Hurrah.
Other part of the show where we talk about links. So, Carrington,
it is a
what links do you have?
Podcast. I actually have links. Normally, I'm like, I got nothing, or I'll say I'm going to Kansas Fest. But I actually have some things. I watched. I finally got around to watching the Silicon Cowboys different documentary. I watched the Silicon Cowboys documentary on Netflix, and that's the one about the founding and initial years of Compaq computers. I was never a fan of Compaq. I was never a Windows person, but there's only so many vintage computer things on Netflix, so you eventually get around to all of them. And I watched it. I came to the documentary, I think, with a different sort of mindset, because I came not as a fan of Compaq, but as a person who thought they were just like a clone. That's just people who started up a computer company and couldn't invent anything of their own.
Right.
So I went in fairly negative. It didn't really change my mind on that, to be honest. But it was interesting to watch. And it's interesting to see, like, it was made from people who were fans of Compaq and what it did, and that they were the David up against the Goliath. I'm like, you were all the Goliath, whatever. So it was neat to watch. One thing that struck me, I was never a fan of luggables. I've never understood it. But that was, you know, when they launched with the Compaq Portable, that was the thing that set the stage for them. And it's interesting that they were talking about, like, it was so amazing to come out with a portable computer. And the big deal that was that it was IBM compatible, like completely compatible. But I look at that and think, okay, that's 1983, and it's basically a 30-pound computer, and that's considered a portable. But in 1984, Apple comes out with a, you know, 16-pound computer, same size screen, and that's considered a desktop. So it's amazing what 1 year does. It's like for less money. So it's the next year, the compact was like $3,500. So it's $1,000 more than the initial, the Mac 128K anyway, and 10 pounds more. And so it's amazing what the difference between 1983 and 1984 when it comes to what a portable computer is.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting. I would recommend the movie. I didn't. I'm glad that I saw it, but I was really viewing it from like an outsider perspective when it comes to that era and what I liked about the computers at the time.
Did you watch *Halt and Catch Fire* at all?
I did. I watched the first season of *Halt and Catch Fire*, which is basically compact computers, but as if it was built, as if Steve Jobs, who was also from American Psycho, was the head of it. It goes weird at the very last episode. I hear that that was good in season two. I don't know if there's more season than that, but I never got around to watching that.
Yeah. Now I forget how many seasons there were. I think
at least two, because I know there was more than I saw.
Yes. I think there might be three or four. I think two, if I remember right, two kind of dipped and then three was better or something. But anyway, yeah, I do remember that at least at the beginning, it was sort of modeled on the story of Compaq. That show kind of cycled through a couple different things. So at a certain point, it was also...
Then they went to online things or whatever. But yeah, maybe I'll get around to watching the rest of the show. But anyway, I finally watched the documentary, so I'm glad I did that. Other links I have, somebody on Twitter posted a thing that they had come across, a magneto-restrictive delay line unit, which is basically memory for a calculator that had a bunch of Nixie tube displays. And I'm like, what is magneto restrictive delay line? Well, that is a type of memory I'd never heard of, and it is crazy. So it's amazing the stuff that exists. So it's a form of sequential access RAM, as opposed to the random. We're used to saying RAM, so random access memory. So this is sequential, so it would be SAM, sequential access memory. So imagine a wire, just that's a big long circle, and you send a pulse down the wire, and so you'd say, go off to the left, pulse, and it goes around, and maybe 100 milliseconds later, it comes back to the start. So that 100 milliseconds gives you the amount of time that you can cycle your memory. It's just going to spin around. And if you can send out a pulse every 1 millisecond, then you could have 100 pulses. So you send out pulses 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and eventually it comes around, and pulse 0 comes back in after you've sent pulse 99, and then you can either change it or send it back as it is. And so it's just a cycle of pulses going around. But the magneto-restrictive stuff sends a shock wave, like a torsion, down a wire. So it's not sending electrical pulses down the wire. It has two little pieces of nickel, and it hits the electricity hits the nickel, which causes it to kind of deform, which sends a twist, a torsion, down the wire. It's like a skipping rope. Uh-huh. And it's sending a whole bunch of torsions down and then reading the flexing as it hits the little bit of nickel at the end of the wire. And you just constantly are sending. So it's RAM, or rather SAM. You can watch. You could like look at this memory and see the pulses because they're physically going down this wire in a circle. It is insane. I didn't know this kind of memory existed. I love it. Everything should have stuck with this technology. We have missed out.
Yeah, that's very cool.
It's bonkers.
This sounds sort of similar to something that I vaguely remember, that another kind of memory that was, I think it was actually a long tube or something.
Because there's lots of delay lines. So I've now read about them.
Mercury delay lines.
Yeah, there's mercury delay lines. There's and then eventually there's electric delay lines. Mm. But I like this one. I like the idea that it's basically we're going to send at the speed of sound a little torsion, like a wave that is going to just go down this spirally wire and then come back to the beginning. And then we can either read it, or once we read it, we can change it or not. It's amazing.
So if you had one with a big enough storage, you could actually literally get it to play an MP3.
Mm, but the problem is, like, the more memory you have, also, the longer it takes. Mm. So if you've got a ton of memory, then that means it's a really long wire, and it might take, like, a second and a half to get back to the beginning.
Oh, I thought you meant, it takes a really long time, so it'd be perfect for an MP, for, like, Bohemian Rhapsody.
Well, in a sense, it is, because if you think about it, it's like a record player. It's the same thing. It's just, like, waves, but it's just... Imagine just vibrating a skipping rope, and whether you've done a vibration or not in a given millisecond is what sets a bit. The whole thing is amazing. I just I just find it adorable. And I just had never heard of this kind of memory before. So we'll have a link to that because somebody found one and that's how I learned about it. Another little link to throw in as quickly is there's a couple of arcades in San Francisco called the High Score Arcades. And they have created, or they had created for them, custom Oregon Trail arcade cabinets. So it's really just a vintage computer inside a cabinet. And I think it's running either in emulation, which is most likely, I think, or on an Apple II, because it's got a lot of Apple II stuff in it. And though it's using an IBM Model 1 keyboard in the front, but you can go to these arcades. Now, if you're in or near San Francisco, right before you get in your car to drive out to North Carolina to pick up the auction, you can stop in at either of the two High Score Arcades locations in San Francisco to play Oregon Trail as it was originally meant to be played in an arcade. Which is very weird.
Yeah.
And then the last little link is somebody made or remade a little bit of the This Is America video from Childish Gambino using Mac Paint and Macromind Director on a vintage Macintosh SE, because of course they did. And it's actually pretty cool. So I have a link to that too.
Nice.
Well, I've just given you a link. Back with your Magneto Restrictive Delay Line unit. Carrington, did you want to pop over and buy one?
Yeah. I do not, but I do want to look at one. I see you've got one from the Soviet memory book. Of course this was Soviet memory.
Sure.
Of course.
Yeah. No, I think this is the one that the photo is of.
But it is. I knew I'd seen it somewhere before, and I just couldn't find my link, so...
Yeah, it's not very much.
No, it's quite... Yeah, $125 US.
Yeah. The thing is...
Paul, let our listeners have this one.
Well, I was looking at it, and it does seem like...
No, Paul, let our listeners have it.
How do you use it? That's the question I have. I mean, like...
Who cares?
So I think
who
it would
cares
be
how you use it?
It'd be cool if you could actually make it, like, remember something.
Yeah, I want one that's big enough so that it can actually physically play an MP3 by vibrating.
I like the idea that you'd erase memory by putting your finger on it and waiting.
Yeah.
Oops. Little pulses. I just really like the whole idea behind this. I find so quaint and lovely.
Audio editing by carefully using your finger to edit out the audio.
Just literally tap some stuff into memory.
Or tap it in. Or tap in the beat.
So anyway, those are the extra little sprinkle of links I have for everyone.
Nicely sprinkled.
What do you guys got?
Michael, you are alphabetically next. What do you have?
I bought another scanner. I've been slowly moving through a box of magazines and CD-ROMs, so I should get those up to the Internet Archive. So, I've never put anything up on the Internet Archive before, so that'll be interesting. I've done about 2 years of APC magazines and their cover discs.
Nice.
Cool. Yeah. I've also been attempting to scan some things, and it's slow going. But I've just recently uploaded a couple of things to the Internet Archive. I'm basically just trying to go through my various things and scan them so I can get rid of them. Oh, yes, computer programs for the kitchen. I posted.
Yes. I saw that. I was going to. Yeah, I've got. I've got some recipe book type things as well, which I should drag out of the back of the shelves. But yeah, there was something else that I scanned. It was the Computer Educational Skills Software Resource Collection. So there was a set of 17 floppy disks, 18 sides. So I imaged those and scanned the little bit of material that came with it, and I've currently got that sitting up on my blog. So, if anyone's after any Apple II skills software resource collection, just pop over. Link supplied.
Cool. So otherwise, not a whole lot. I mean, like, the World Cup was going on, and that's distracting. But... And I guess it hasn't been that long.
Yeah.
I feel like there's been no time since the last month. I was doing something or other. I've experimented a little bit with Yahoo auctions in Japan, and using reshipping from there. And
And how'd that go?
Well, I'm not sure yet.
He doesn't know what he bought.
So, I'm at the beginning of this experimenting, but I'll see how reshipping works. But at least it's worked okay for you, Michael, right?
Yeah,
I use a transshipper as well in America to bring stuff up to Canada. So.
Okay, yeah, I'm using Tenso from Japan, but I think that's the normal thing that one does. But anyway, so maybe there's a whole new place to spend money, which is not necessarily good. But anyway, all right. Not much else is going on with me, but Kansas Fest is coming up soon.
Yeah, speaking of transshipping, I thought it was most appropriate that the most recent article that arrived at my transshipping address had the package code of IT. They use the alphabet to go through, so I'm actually trying to get through to ZZ to see what happens after you've bought that many packages. But I just thought that the latest one to arrive was IT.
Perfect. Yeah,
yeah, I can't even remember what IT was.
Well, we're only halfway through the year at this point, right? So like, there's still you might still make it.
Mm. Yes. So what happens after you get to ZZ? They just give you a new account and you start it at AA again? I don't know.
Probably that's actually true, because the odds that they still have AA on hand when you get to I would have said ZZ, but yeah. I guess I'm alone.
Sorry, what was that? I heard this buzzing noise. Zeds, my friend. Zed.
Yes.
You're outnumbered.
At this point, I think I am, yes.
Yes. Carrington, say Zed.
Jif.
Perfect.
Yeah, excellent.
And Karateka, I think, right?
Okay. I think we'll wrap it up now.
Yeah, that's about it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss our pronunciations in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And until next time,
Retro Compute!